first paper, we are going to hear about memoranda of understanding and researcher contracts respecting ownership, benefit, and control in language documentation by a team of Eva Tchaikovsky Higgins, Brian Tom, Deanna Daniels, and Suzanne Urbancic, who isn't here right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. We'd just like to begin by saying mahalo to the Hawaiian people for welcoming us to their very beautiful territories. And we're here from the west coast of Canada to talk about a project that we all collaborated on. And as Pat said, there's three of us here. My name is Eva Tchaikovska, and I was the principal investigator and the director of this project for the majority of the time that the project was going on. And then Huaiwat was the chair of the steering committee for the project. And our colleague Suzanne Urbancic, who wasn't able to come with us to Hawaii, was one of the co-investigators. And then Brian was a collaborator on the project and was also a negotiator for the Hukkaminam Treaty Group. As we all know, one area of critical importance for language documentation work involves ethical concerns related to ownership, benefit, and control. And particularly, this is an important issue today because archiving and open source publication and access are increasingly being discussed in linguistics and language documentation work. And so questions such as the ones that are on this slide become particularly significant. So who has ownership and control over project outcomes? Who benefits? Who determines the answers to these questions? Who has access to language information? And what instruments or mechanisms can be used to address these kinds of questions? We participated in a wide-ranging, long-term project in Coastal Edge Territory. And at the very beginning of this project, the elders' advisory groups for the project expressed various concerns. So they were concerned about how academic researchers would treat knowledge of land and culture. And they were really concerned to retain ownership of customary stories and related teachings. They didn't want outsiders to profit from traditional knowledge and their oral narratives. And they wanted to protect very special forms of knowledge, which were held by families as their intangible property. And these were these stories, or this knowledge, was rooted in customary laws that were respected and upheld in the communities. They also wanted to make sure that outsiders were accountable to these laws, and they wanted to mitigate potential social or spiritual impacts that could arise from misuse of private family knowledge. And of course, these kinds of concerns are rooted in both the economic disadvantage that Canadian First Nations are in relative to neighboring non-Native communities, but also their long-standing sense of community and collective propriety over their cultural traditions. So how does one address the elders' concerns? And what we want to suggest following on the work that we did is that in a language documentation project, it is essential to develop structures for encouraging respect for community control, benefit, ownership, and protection of intangible cultural property. It's essential to be responsible to the community members and or to community partners. Reciprocity and relevance in research process and results are essential. And framing and being accountable to research relationships for the long term beyond the project is also really important. And these essentially are the R's of Indigenous research, as stated and laid out in the work of people like Kirkness and Barnhart, Wilson and Waver-Pillox, all of whom are Indigenous Canadian researchers. And so one way to respect these R's is through formal agreements and arrangements, such as memoranda of understanding or researcher contracts, which refer to and respect customary laws and protocols of each Indigenous community. And so what we're going to do today is illustrate one collaborative community-based project on Coast Salish territory that tried to address conventional intellectual property through a formal arrangement. And one of the things in our illustration is that intellectual property has been addressed by laying out principles for how to respect and protect Indigenous intangible property in ways that are not covered by conventional intellectual property systems. And one of the things that we hope you'll sort of see is that by practicing research in the Coast Salish way, we were actually able to address national concerns like the OCAP, which we'll talk about later, and international concerns. So I'll turn over to Deanna.
OCMCI, Homuk Mistimuk, Hawaii Mistimuk, Hatsatka. It's also a protocol for indigenous people like me to acknowledge the people of the land that were welcomed here. So I'm here to introduce the Coast Salish Language Revitalization Cure Project, which I was involved in. It was initially a 5-year project, but it was extended to an 8-year project, which has become a very valuable project and model for other nations who and collaborating partners are going to work with indigenous people. So it was initiated in 2001. We're going to discuss language projects that came out of the project. There were 19 in total. There were 10 projects were from the Halkominum language group, which did documentation and revitalization projects. There were 9 Sinchathan documentation and revitalization projects, which not only were in duration, but they did continue after the project. There was governance and intellectual property rights and linguistic projects and methodology projects. The collaboration was an effort of 5 strong collaborating partners. Okay. 5 strong collaborating partners, which really made a difference for the whole project, its success and uniqueness. So it involved the Spanish Native Heritage Society, which is the Sinchathan language group, the Halkominum Treaty Group, and the First Peoples Heritage Language and Culture Council, First Peoples Culture Foundation, and the University of Victoria. There's a picture, a map of Canada, and you see here in the red is where the on Vancouver Island, which is very west coast on the south Vancouver Island where the languages live. I really found really passion in working with this project because this involved the communities that, the languages that were really important to me. My father was a Halkominum language speaker, and that's what I did my master's project in as well, in the Halkominum language. And the Sinchathan group where I live. So, in the communities, the project was very large. In the Halkominum language group, there were 6 First Nations communities, which involved 6,200 people. And in the Sinchathan language group, there were 4 language communities, 4 community members involved, and 2,900 people, all involved with the project. So you see how diverse it was. And the purpose of the project was to contribute to a living language in heritage in HCG and SNS communities, which were the language communities. So we were to produce research materials, build capacity in the community, in research and culture and protocol, which are all very important to think about when you're working with the communities, because all of these are very relevant to language revitalization, useful to the communities and the universities, which everyone, it was a win-win for everybody. It was a solid partnership with the language communities, and it was a project that we had to find a way to work together. It was such a large project, 2 different languages, and a university. So, we don't have a good history in our First Nations communities with languages, right? So this makes it very unique. So we were able to show how to respect culture and protocol, and enable conditions that allow revitalization not only to take place during the project, but to continue. And there are projects out there right now that show that this, how successful this project is, that it is continuing. It has had a ripple effect into the community. We put a title on this called Empowering Governance Structure, because we had 2 different committees. One was the Elders Committee, which we know in our communities, the elders are our knowledge keepers. They have the knowledge and the wisdom, and they know what they want for their language, for now and for the future, because
you know, the BC languages right now are in a critical state, right? So it's very important that they do their work at the time. So the elders committee there was one from each community. These elders provided the direction, the goals, what did they want to do and how they wanted it done. So they were provided that direction. They made a recommendation to the steering committee, which I'm gonna talk about next, but that was really, really valuable because it was from the community, not from the top down, it was from the bottom up, from the community. The steering committee had equal chairs on the steering committee, which were the leaders, the leadership group. The two from the two organizations, two from each language group, and two from the University of Victoria. So because there was funding involved, a 5-year project, like about $1 million, so there was a lot of things to organize. So this leadership organized how the money was going to be spent and divided and how the projects were going to take place. So I'm going to, yes. So there you go, thank you.
I'm Brian Tom, and I'm here to talk about the actual MOU and researcher contracts that we implemented in the CURA project. And we just wanted to set out front that really there are two things going on when we're trying to deal with these interests. There's really the Indigenous law that deals with the intangible cultural heritage and the matters of concern, sort of central concern in the Indigenous community, and then there's the kind of conventional or mainstream Western law, like copyright, patents, and trademarks, and of course the Western law doesn't deal very well or in terms that work very well for Indigenous communities, but sometimes things like copyright can get in the way of the objectives of the Indigenous communities, so we wanted to get a handle on those things and use the conventional tools that were at our disposal, like contracts and memorandums of understanding, so that the objectives that the Indigenous community has around respecting the intangible cultural heritage and making sure that the any kind of wealth or royalties generated from the project was being directed in an appropriate way. And so we set up this kind of framework of an MOU and research contracts to get a handle on that. And this is consistent with the approach that other scholars have suggested, that really we can't wait around for the federal government or for WIPO to revise the Copyright Act to come up with some sui generis instrument that will handle all of the concerns that are happening in the communities. We need to act at the community level and take charge of what we can at home. And so we've done this here through this two-step approach. The first is a memorandum of understanding between the university and the communities. And this was signed by the VP Research of UVic after a lengthy discussion about its terms. And I have to say where UVic, I think, ceded its position in a number of areas and really aligned with what the communities were trying to achieve, and researcher contracts, which were binding on the researchers, which signed them, and which lasted longer than the life of the funded research project itself. The researchers who signed this contract are really in perpetuity bound by the terms of the contract in respect to the things that it deals with, and. So just to clarify that the memorandum of understanding is not an instrument we could rely on if there was a dispute and we had to go to court. It is an agreement to work together in a certain way, kind of a handshake, a relationship. Whereas the contract really is a binding arrangement between the researcher, the individual, and the community who was the signatory to it. So to go over the components of these things, and they're long documents, so I won't be able to go through all the components, but they are available online. A copy of the signed memorandum of understanding is available on the website, which we provide a link to, and a blank version of the researcher contracts is available through the UVic Cura Project website. So if you're interested in looking at all the crunchy bits inside those, you can go and download them. But I'll highlight a few things. So in terms of the relationship between the university and the communities and the MOU, the MOU set out a clear process for decision making. This was very important, that what Deanna was talking about earlier about research governance, and that the communities had a very clear and inclusive decision making role, not merely an advisory role in how the monies were spent and what projects became priorities. It established how to deal with things in the short term during the process and what was going to happen over the long term. It looked at setting out some things that would be then later set out in the consent forms to inform the community members who were going to participate in the project what they might be concerned about divulging and what they might be fine with divulging. And there were things that the community didn't really want to have out circulating in the public domain or anything like this. It made some cautions there so people could use their judgment. And then it made very specific acknowledgments about what the intentions were around who would have copyright in the recordings, who would have copyright in the notes, what would the disposition of these things be in the long term. And then it also suggested that in whatever contracts were signed, that researchers would also have some security. That they would have a limited license to publish for scholarly purposes the materials. And some directions were made there about how royalties, if any, were made. And I don't know how many linguists in the room are making royalties off their work, but you know, there is a concern in the community that this might happen. And in fact, it's happened in some cases. And so some assurances were made about the flow of any of those potential royalties should they happen. And it also made a list of topics that were really too sensitive that everybody agreed at the outset they weren't going to get into, the kind of sacred realm, the kind of realm that are very very personal family matters that they didn't want to get out into to be not recorded. And there was some work done around describing what those were. And then a dispute resolution mechanism was built in so that, again, it was back to the elders, and the elders would have some ability to really resolve disputes and make decisions about what would happen if there was a dispute. So again, an empowering framework there. In terms of the researcher contracts, again, these are in effect for forever for the researchers who sign them. They're firm covenants, and they involved a number of commitments that the researchers would make in terms of what they would and would not do and what they would and would not publish. And you can look at those for the details of what those commitments are. And importantly, the First Nation the two nations who were working on this agreed on an organization who would be assigned the copyright in the material. So when you turn the tape recorder on, by default, it's the owner of the medium of recording who's the owner of the copyright in that performance, right? So if you bought the tape, you're the one who gets the copyright, which is not how we wanted it to work. So we had to redirect the default system so that the organization, in this case the Holcomb Treaty Group, would be the one that would be assigned the copyright in that. And the contracts then provided a license for the scholar to publish for non-commercial purposes. And also required that the scholar made arrangements for a permanent repository, but that also in those arrangements, any of the kind of conditions that the people who were involved in the project would have made on their consent form would adhere to those issues. So try to spell out all of these sort of longer term relationship issues. And finally, on the consent form, we tried to make it abundantly clear to the person who was sharing the information that the information that they were sharing was going to be the copyright in that would be assigned to the First Nations organization, so that they understood that when that tape goes on, they were giving it really a gift to the nation, that the nation would then own those words and the tape. And so there was this what we call this kind of lock, stock, and barrel agreement that the intellectual property was then assigned to the nation.
Okay, so I'm mindful that we just have a couple of minutes left, so, and of course we have 15 slides left, but so what I'm just going to do is highlight what I think are the most important things. So as far as the value of what we try to do is concerned, I think that one of the most important things is that the university intellectual policy applies to the project activities and the outcomes, but this is subject to the agreements in the MOU and the research contract. So that means that the Hukkaminam and Ksenich people's customary stories and related teachings did not become the property of the university or of the researchers that were affiliated with the project. So that, I think, is maybe the most wonderful thing about what the negotiations and the agreement achieved. And then there was really an inclusive and empowering process for the First Nations involved, but also for all of us who were involved, for the university as well. The university did have to bend quite a bit in this, and I think that we were all grateful for that. There are limitations to this. So one thing, just to say right from the start, is that these legal agreements were able to be enacted because we had a university working together with the Hukkaminam Treaty Group and the Saanich Group, but the Hukkaminam Treaty Group had a really strong legal team at that time, and so that really helped a lot. Does that mean that other groups can't do similar things? No, it doesn't. It just means that what other groups can do have to be fit into what the possibilities are in each team, in each group, but also if one keeps principles of respect in mind, and if one makes sure to have dialogue, then a lot of things can be worked out. And then the very last thing that I wanted to say is that, or that we were working on together, is that what this ended up allowing us to kind of see was the value of self-determination for all of the communities involved. And this self-determination is really tied to the Canadian First Nations principles of OCAP, ownership, control, access, and possession. And it's also tied to the statements that are made by international articles like the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So just to kind of end, neither UN bodies nor state governments have been willing to consider that acknowledgement of Indigenous rights with respect to traditional knowledge or traditional cultural heritage necessarily involves acceptance of the principle of self-determination for Indigenous peoples. So to support self-determination, we'd like to suggest that it is essential to use local instruments, local arrangements, and local mechanisms, such as the ones that the Coast Salish groups involved in our project used. And through this, there's the potential to empower communities to act on their own behalf. And empowerment and self-determination are obviously closely connected to well-being in a community. Haichika.
So we have about 7 minutes for questions.
I don't have a question, I more have a comment. When you're quoting UNDRIP, you cross-reference it with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples of the Organization of American States, because they reference each other, the declaration that is stronger and can override in some principles in the other one. That's the one that will stand the day.
Okay.
So it's
thank you.
Yeah. We'll tie that in.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
Thank you very much. Colin?
I don't know if I understand the slow food movement right, but I think that what they are doing is it's a long process. Having things be organic, sustainable. It seems like your project, your collaboration, your MOU, is an evidence for the kinds of slow collaborations. and how they can yield productive fruit for everyone involved. It's I don't know if you could talk about the, you talked about the MOU, but obviously this didn't come down because someone who didn't know the community walked in and said, hey, let's submit this grant.
Do you want to respond? This project arose out of long-standing relationships between most of the members of the university and the communities that that were involved in the project. And it, one of the things that we didn't have time to say was that the project was actually initiated by Stolpuff John Elliott Sr., who is a language champion in British Columbia. And it was his vision to come to the university and suggest that we work together to try and find funding to do language revitalization work. And then it kind of grew from there because Sue Banzik and Tom Hukari had very strong relationships with the Halkominum Treaty Group, and Brian was involved and had relationships. And so it was very much a result of people knowing each other and honestly caring a lot about each other in all directions, I would say. Megan.
How much pushback did you get from the university when you're trying to change it, or from SHRT?
I don't know if this works.
You have to turn yours on.
I think I got it. My understanding of the key sticking point at the university, Shirk was silent on the matter, but the key sticking point for the university was that the UVic has their intellectual property policy, and the default position is that is the policy that nothing else can be in conflict with, and the terms of the MOU were not consistent with the policy. They made things in favor of the First Nation, and so it took quite a bit of discussion and eventually a decision by the VP Research to say, all right, in this one instance, the policy of the university is not going to take precedence over the arrangement we want to have with the First Nation, which I think was a very strong move for UVic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
are you?
As I see this, through a short partnership grant that involves a multitude of different Indigenous nations and groups, we've done something very similar, and I think we've arrived at actually very similar kind of conclusions about this, where the university does not claim or have copyright ownership of any of the materials, but really is the facilitator, helper. We also created a grant steering committee. Some of our researchers were perhaps, like university-based researchers, was a little bit unusual, which clearly puts the direction of the grant in the hands of the First Nations communities as opposed to university researchers. And it's worked well. But I have, around having done this for a good number of years, one issue that sometimes maybe we don't think about is that Indigenous nations, First Nations, whoever we deal with and whatever we call one another and ourselves, in the end are represented by institutions,
mm-hmm.
which, whether we like it or not, in some ways are connected to Western bureaucracies, and sometimes majorly so. And those kind of institutions sometimes have a long shelf life, and sometimes they don't. And so throughout my many years of doing this and working in and with communities, sometimes that can pose some unforeseen difficulties, maybe 20, 30 years down the line or so. And we've certainly gone through this in the Secwepemc Nation. So that I would really like to invite researchers to think long-term there. And so sometimes out of the box of what these institutional constraints in a given moment might mean. And another thing is just around Indigenous institutions being, in the end, how to say it, so caught up in Western bureaucracies, not necessarily because they want to. Sometimes the lawyers in our own institutions become our worst enemies, not because they want to hamper research or something, but because things sometimes get tied up for the longest time in the bureaucratic entanglements.
Yeah, thank you. You're raising very important points, and I think it's really critical for all of us to talk about the kinds of challenges that have come up, because it's only in that way that we'll all be able to find solutions. And there are all kinds of small or big challenges that come up when we're trying to do this kind of work together. And again, talking, dialogue, making sure that there's open lines of communication is critical for all of this. And so I'm really glad that you raised these points, because I think they're very important. Thank you.
Thank you.
The URL for us to access the documents?
So one of the, do you want us to post it?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Are you going to share your?
You were going to share the PowerPoint, yeah.
The URL's on there, one of them.
The URL is on one of them. I don't remember which one, but.
I was,
Sarah?
Yeah, I was just wondering, what was that cross-reference you mentioned?
Oh, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that was done by the Organization of American States.
Yeah.
And UNDRIP.
Thank you for the discussion. I'm sorry, I think we'll have to draw to a close. Thank you very much.